like smicha, rabbonus, and women's ordination, just to make it a little controversial, why not, right? But seriously, it's between last week's Haftarah and this week's Parsha, it makes a lot of sense, this topic. Last week's Haftarah deals with Devorah, being the shofet, or shofetess of Klal Yisrael. So she judged, presumably, Klal Yisrael, if that's what the definition of shofet is. And this week, we find out that Moshe Rabbeinu was to appoint judges. Yisro comes, he sees Moshe judging cases all day, and he complains to Moshe, or he gives some constructive criticism to Moshe, I should say. Moshe listens, asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu, finds out that that's appropriate, and sets up a whole judicial system. So, we find the idea of appointing judges, and Devorah being able to judge, and we'll have to see where contemporary smicha perhaps is an outgrowth of an original smicha process, which may have, or in fact we'll see, did really have to do with specifically the judicial process, not necessarily psak din and rabbanus as we see it in today's day and age, but really adjudicating specific types of civil, corporal, and capital cases. So let's start with the original smicha and work our way down historically. The Rambam tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu gave smicha to Yehoshua, and it was then passed down from one Rebbe to Talmud, or not necessarily only one person in a generation, but smicha was given to several or many people in each generation. Once one receives this type of smicha, they're able to give it to whomever they choose. They're hopefully only going to give it to people qualified. We find historically some Tanaim and, perhaps even Amoraim, early Amoraim, who were more reserved in terms of to whom they would give smicha to, and others who were relatively more liberal and giving it to more Talmid. There are a lot of rules about this type of smicha. It can be given for a duration of time. It can be given just for 2 years, 3 years, and then automatically suspended. It is something that, although initially it seems there may have been the ability to give it outside of Eretz Yisrael, once, at one point in time, it became confined to only being allowed to be given within the borders of Eretz Yisrael itself. It does not require the actual placement of one's hands on the Talmud's head. And the Gemara actually questions, where do we know this smicha process from? And it says, is it from the pasuk where it says that Moshe was somech his hands on Yehoshua? Moshe actually put his hands on Yeshua's head. And the Gemara says no, because if that were true, then it would also be necessary to physically place one's hands on the Talmud's head, which we know is not the case. That was only done in that situation as somewhat of a bracha or a chizuk or whatever. But the procedure is essentially just the Rebbe saying to the Talmud, you have permission, you're now called Rebbe. Now, for what purpose is the smicha? In general, it's to deal with certain types of civil cases. Knossos, for example, fines, penalties. There are different types of civil cases. One civil case can be where I hit somebody's car with my car accidentally, so I have to pay damages. That's not dealing with punitive damages whatsoever. I'm physically paying for the damages that I've caused. I'm not paying any more or less. It's not a set amount either. It's not a fine. It's specifically I have to pay the appropriate damage that I did to the other person's car. Whereas there are other cases which clearly are punitive. If I'm a ganav, if I break into somebody's home in the middle of the night and I steal things, my punishment, in addition to returning the stolen object, I have to pay a penalty of the amount of the stolen object. I have to pay that in addition to the object itself. Kefil. I have to pay double what I've stolen, the stolen object itself, plus this penalty. That's a penalty. Other things are penalties. If my ox gores someone else's slave, there's a set amount prescribed in the Torah, 30 shekel. That's obviously a penalty. That can't be damages by definition. Because if it's a set amount, then I'm not evaluating what the eved is worth. He could be worth a shekel. And I'm paying 30. But yes, there can be cases where he's worth more, and I'm let off the hook. However, the fact that it's given as a set amount means the Torah was not concerned. Rashi seems to discuss this a little bit in Bava Kamma. The Torah was not concerned with paying damages in the case. There's a fine for killing someone's eved, or an eved being killed with the negligence of one's not guarding his ox.
Isn't there a shekel related to the idea of what redemption for the Beis HaMikdash is worth? I mean, that
not necessarily. I mean, you may find corresponding fees elsewhere, but it's not an actual worth of a person. You know, it's not his physical worth. And as I said, there can be situations where you're getting off, you know, without a fine. At the same time, Lamashal, I heard someone who, when she was in school, she may or may not be related to me, she may or may not be my wife. So the parking cost, I forgot how much it was a month. And after noticing there was a certain fire hydrant that was right in front of the school, much more convenient than the lot, and it was noticed between the carpool that cops only gave a ticket about once a month. And if they would split the ticket once a month, it would be ridiculously cheaper than paying for parking, and it was significantly more convenient. So it may or may not have been decided to park in that area. Now, is that a fine? It's a fine. By parking in front of the hydrant, there is whatever the fine is. In the meantime, it was cheaper than the parking fee and even more convenient. So it is a fine, even if it's getting let off the hook somewhat. It's saying there's a set fee for doing an illegal behavior. Okay, that may or may not have happened. This is being taped, so we don't want any incriminating evidence. Anyhow, so to adjudicate such cases, one needs smicha. Therefore, in places where smicha is not prevalent or existent at certain points in time, such as in Bavel, remember, in order to receive smicha, the procedure had to have been done in Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, it was uncommon for places, especially places that were significantly distant from Eretz Yisrael, not just outside the border, to have people who were smuchim, to have people who had received smicha, and to actually have a court that had received smicha. Therefore, in Bavel, they did not have smicha, and they could not adjudicate such cases. What would happen if there was a case that somebody harmed another person, and the other person wanted payment for including the punitive damages, not just the actual damages? So what was instituted over time was a procedure that, and the Gemara discusses this, that should the plaintiff say, I want to go to Eretz Yisrael, I want to travel to Eretz Yisrael in order to be able to have my case heard by people who are qualified to hear this case, we allow him to do so. And in fact, over time it developed that should the defendant refuse, then the defendant would be shunned by the community, there would be a cherem imposed on him, until such time that either he and the plaintiff met and compromised and settled the matter out of court, or the two traveled to Eretz Yisrael and actually had the case heard and to have it settled up. Therefore, we would force people to have these cases settled or heard in a court that was capable of having this. So that is where the original smicha came. Smicha was also necessary for corporal punishment and for capital punishment. Non-smuchim are unable to rule in such cases. Now, smicha at this point in time is certainly batal. The Rambam, as we said, mentioned that smicha started, and subsequent Rishonim all mentioned, it seems to start from Moshe giving it to Yoshua and onwards. Where did they get that from? Interestingly enough, we don't find anywhere in the Gemara that that is mentioned. We don't find that Moshe gave it to Yoshua and this whole chain of events all the way down the line. In fact, the Rambam has a theoretical way to reinstate smicha. He himself seems to be a little doubtful whether it really works. But in Hilchos Sanhedrin, he says, should all the rabbinic figures of Eretz Yisrael, they're the only ones who are considered here, should they all reach a consensus to reinstate smicha, they can all agree on one person to give smicha to, that will restart smicha, and that person then has the ability to give smicha to anyone else, and therefore you can reinstate a Sanhedrin from that point on. There are those who disagree with this ability. It seems to be that their disagreement comes to the pasuk where it says that Eliyahu HaNavi will come back. Beheshev levavos, abanav levanam, the whole thing, right? Hinei anochi shoyechem as Eliyahu HaNavi. So Eliyahu HaNavi in that pasuk, who is that? If you hold, like some Rishonim, that it's Eliyahu HaNavi himself, and it's not just a name to discuss the characteristics of this Navi, who's not, in fact, Eliyahu. Keep in mind, we do have Pesukim to talk about David coming in the future, that many Rishonim say, no, it means a descendant of David, somebody who will carry on David's legacy. So if you hold that this is Eliyahu himself, then Eliyahu is a Samuch, and he can reinstate Smicha. You don't need a way to reinstate Smicha to have a new Sanhedrin. So in order for the Sanhedrin to come back, Eliyahu HaNavi could come back in corporal form and be able to give smicha to somebody else, and that's it. But the Rambam perhaps doesn't learn this way, and he learns that it's referring to a Navi, who for whatever reason the Navi in this Nevuah is telling us is referred to as Eliyahu HaNavi.
Where in the passage do we say anything about smicha?
We don't. But since there will be a Navi to rise and be the, you know, bringing about of Mashiach, if, as generally we say, Eliyahu HaNavi, which comes from this pasuk, if it's him, then it could work, theoretically. But according to the Rambam, if it's not, without somebody coming back from the dead, we're unable to start it, so you have a new procedure. Now, where the Rambam got it from is debatable. And keep in mind, he himself seems to have been a little misupik whether it would work, but he has a new mechanism to start smicha without having to have somebody come back from the dead. There are those in academic circles who have suggested that with this mechanism, we don't need to have had smicha initially. Meaning, maybe smicha was only din derabbanan. We don't have anything in the Torah itself that we know that tells us there was an idea of smicha. In Shas, we never find that they say it's a din d'oraisa. They never told us that Moshe gave it to Yoshua, etc., etc. That's the Rambam who suggested that. Shas couldn't find the pasuk. So, therefore, it's possible that this mechanism was instated by the Chachamim. Given the Rambam himself would certainly disagree with this. And then it fell apart. So if all the Chacham and Meretz Yisrael would want to reinstate it, they would do the original procedure. What these people bring, and this is why I'm coming to this, because I'm not necessarily subscribing to this opinion, but what they suggest is, they say, look, how do you know if somebody has smicha in the Gemara? When you look at a Tana and a Mora, so there's a difference between Rebbe somebody and Rav somebody. In general, not always, but in general, if you find the title Rebbe, that person has smicha. If you find the title Rav, that person does not have smicha. And that is pretty much across the boards. Therefore, that's what you find in Bavel, almost everybody is Rav so-and-so, or just plain Shmuel, with no title at all. Whereas in Eretz Yisrael, it'll be Rebbe Zera. In fact, Rashi maintains, sometimes you find Rav Zera, and sometimes you see Rebbe Zera. We know Rebbe Zera, traveled between Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. One was prior to his initial ascent to Eretz Yisrael. He was only Rav Zera, because he hadn't gone there. He never received smicha. Once he got there, he achieved smicha, and then he got changed, so to speak, to be Rebbe Zera.
Rav was the title Rav.
So that's what I want to get into. That may be more like a Rabbanus type, even if it's not identical to what we have, maybe similar to what we have nowadays. So this smicha, which remember, doesn't mean to adjudicate regular cases. It's knossos, it's punitive damages, it's malchus and misa, that kind of thing. So that gives the title Rebbe. We don't find in Mishnah, in the Tanaitic sources, we don't find the term Rebbe until the essentially the Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabban, we find. Rabban connotes the Nasi. The Nun at the end tells me we're not just dealing with Rebbe. Keep in mind, this all comes essentially from the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is the grand Beis Din. They're the, so to speak, source of all smaller Batei Dinim. The head of the major Beis Din, meaning the Sanhedrin, was called the Nasi. He was given the title Rabban. And then everybody else, it would seem, is Rabbi. But even that, the first Rabban we find is Rabban Gamliel, the elder, right, a descendant or the son of Hillel. Then we have Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, the elder. Then we have Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. Then Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, you know, his son. Then we have Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who wasn't given the title Rabban, but essentially that family. It's only until Hillel's child, Rabban Gamliel, the elder, that we find the title Rabban. But even then we don't find Rebbe. Nobody has the title of Rebbe. Right? The Nesim before that, Hillel, it's not Rabban Hillel. We don't find Rabban Yossi ben Yoezer, it's Yossi ben Yoezer. There was no title. We have Shammai, we have Hillel, we have Avtalion, we have Shmaya, we have these people, they don't have title. So it's been suggested that at one point, for whatever reason, they wanted to show that Nasi was a very powerful individual. He had Rabban, and a few generations later, at the time of the Churban, essentially, they wanted to show the idea of smicha in general, so people all of a sudden started getting smicha, and Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai enacted this idea. That's been suggested in some academic circles. I think where the Rambam was coming from and why he would reject such a theory is that the Gemara didn't seem to say, do we have a pasuk? Is this deraisa? The Gemara took for granted that this is biblical. And therefore said, what is the pasuk? Not do we have a pasuk because is it midrash or midrabbanan? And it assumed that Moshe gave it to Yoshua, and it found a pasuk that seemed to indicate that, and said, no, if that were the source, then you would need to put your hands on the Talmud. But the idea of it was agreed upon that Moshe gave such a thing to Yoshua. I don't know if in academic circles they would agree to such a proof. Just because the Gemara held it, they would say it doesn't prove what really happened historically. But the Rambam certainly may be swayed by such an argument. And therefore, that's it. Why do we find this difference? And this is, I think, a very important part which is going to play into the women's ordination part. A lot to cover. Not much time. Maybe we might make this a part one and part two series. Why do we find the title? So, not perhaps addressing this point, but there's an interesting tshuva from the Chasam Sofer. He was asked about Shul Rabbonim, whether when they pass away, their children are given priority to taking the position. And initially, he says no. We find in Shas an idea that Torah is not a Yerusha. Torah is not an inheritance. It's free for anybody to take. Whoever is most qualified takes it. So, if a rabbinic position is to teach Torah and to give psak halacha, whoever is most qualified has a right to that position, and it's not inherited, a child doesn't receive that position. However, leadership, community leadership positions, do in fact have inherited status. We find by Melucha, by the king, his children get first priority when the king passes away. Who is going to stand in the place to succeed his father? The line of succession. What's that going to be? It goes to the children first. So there is a criterion that the child has to be memale mekom avosov. He has to be competent. And competent of the same level of competency that the father was. If the child is not going to be as competent as the last person who had the position, as the father, then, and the oldest child goes before the younger children, then we'll go down the line of inheritance, younger children, whoever is the most qualified within that, and if they can't, then maybe if the father who had passed away, if he had a brother, nephews, whatever it's going to be, we stay within the family, we start branching out. But it is within people who are qualified for the position, it stays as a Yerusha. When it comes to Torah positions, that's not the case. So, huh?
Chassidus.
So, how are you going to address? It's a dynasty, right? It's a, but they do see it as a melucha, as a malchus, right? So the malchus goes from one to the next. Why is that? I think they would tell you it's a Torah position. So I think that's the second half that the Chasam Sofer says. So initially he says it stands to reason that it's not an inherited position. Then he says, however, that's not true. Because in as much as in contemporary times a Rav does in fact deal with Psak Halacha and teaching Torah, in addition to that he's also a community leader. And he also deals with the more mundane situations and community affairs and community problems. And nowadays we would probably throw into that counseling and dealing with all sorts of issues of, you know, setting up school systems. And you know, they may be mitzvahs, but it's not specifically Torah. Making sure the mikvahs are set up, you know, set up appropriately. Making sure the kashrus is appropriate. All these things which may have Torah values to them, but aren't teaching Torah and aren't rendering halachic decisions per se. They're actually physically taking care of things and helping the community. So they're community leaders in as much as they are also Torah leaders. Then it takes on the personality of having the Yerusha. So long as the child will at least be as competent as the father, he has first rights to the position. And that's how he ends up. And that would be similar to, you know, these dynastic Hasidus, I assume, would be the same reason. So he mentions that what you see is, it's very interesting. We don't find any Yerusha with the Nasi. The Mishnah in Chagiga, until a certain point in time, the Mishnah in Chagiga tells us of many Nasim. Yossi ben Yoezer, I mentioned Shmaya, and, you know, going down all this time. Hillel started a dynasty. Prior to Hillel, it wasn't a dynasty. It was seemingly whoever was most capable. Whoever was the best at the job was able to fill that position. In fact, Yossi ben Yoezer, a different mission in Chagiga, tells us he was a Kohen. So he couldn't have been from Hillel's family because Hillel was from Davinot's family. He wasn't a Kohen. So we know Hillel wasn't a Kohen, so he wasn't a grandchild from Yossi ben Yoezer who was a Kohen. So what changed? What seems to have changed is that you had a melech, you had the recognized community leader to deal with the community aspects, and that was the melech and his, you know, delegates were taking care of the communal affairs, and the nasi was in charge of taking care of the Torah affairs and not the communal affairs. In fact, there's a Piskei Tosfos that mentions this, that even when they had a melech, they always had a nasi, and the melech was charged with taking care of the physical needs of the tzibur. And the Nasi was charged with taking care of the spiritual needs of the Tzibur, rendering Psak Din, he's the head of the Sanhedrin. But what changed was that Hordus, Herod, took over the Melucha, so to speak. He took over the monarchy. Not that it had been the best for a couple kings prior to him, but things got really bad then. So in order to show that this Melucha, that Herod had no claim to the kingdom at all. He was an Eved, Chazal teaches. He didn't even have Yichus that could make him part of, you know, a king. Not that the ones before him were from Yehuda, they were Kohanim, but they weren't Avadim. So because they wanted to show that the kingship now doesn't even have recognizable kingship to it, they included some communal affairs to the position of the Nasi, starting with Hillel, who was contemporaneous with Herod. And from that point on, it became an inherited position, which we actually see. So the first one to assume the position of Rabban was his son. Now, Because there can be a big pitfall. There could be, this is me talking now, not the Chasam Sofer. People could say, why did he get the job? Until now, it wasn't just someone qualified who happened to be the son of the last Nasi. It was whoever was most qualified. Why should Rebbe Gamliel, not that he wasn't qualified, and he may have been the best for the job, don't get me wrong, but why is he just because he's a son? It never worked that way before. So they gave a new title to show this new characteristic. This is a new position, so to speak, carved out, starting from Hillel, the dynasty. He's the first son, and from that point on, it went with that. At the Churban, the rest of the Sanhedrin was still recognized. At the Churban, and people are being spread out to many more areas, it was very important to show the authority of the Sanhedrin as a whole and its delegates who would be spread out through Eretz Yisrael to whatever other regions that they may travel from. So perhaps before there was an idea of smicha, but they never needed the title Rebbe. If you were acting as a judge, presumably you had smicha. Well, now there's a churban. Now there's more spread out, you know, through different regions. The Sanhedrin itself is on the move at certain points in time, and different persecutions. So in order to give chashivas to that body of the Sanhedrin and its delegates, they actually gave them a title, not that the position didn't exist before, but the title. That's my theory. So either way, that's what Rebbe is. And that's, I think, what would be the more traditional approach and the response to that academic, taina of you don't see the title. What was Rav? Rav was a posek. Rav, meaning not Rav the person, he was also a posek. He may have received some level of smicha, that's a different story. But the title Rav just meant you're a recognized Torah authority to render halach decisions. In Bavel, that was Rav. Ploni, whoever it was. Many cases also, it wasn't just Isser Vehater, it wasn't just Yoredei, what we would call, like, is this Chayf, is the woman Tameh, is this that. It was also, frequently, that he would be on a Beis Din, and he would rule in civil matters. He couldn't rule on Knossos, he couldn't rule on punitive damages, but he could rule on basic civil matters and civil disputes. So that's what we have. When did Smicha itself end? The traditional Mahalach is, and the Ramban mentions this, in the time of Hillel II, which is in the time of Abai and Rava, really it would be 7 years after Rava passed away, in the year 359, was when Smicha was finally abolished. There are those who contend, there's a person, Chaim Michiel Bornstein, he, maybe Bornstein, I'm not sure how to pronounce last name. He published in a publication journal somewhat called Hatkufa in 1918. He published a thing that he traced that in Eretz Yisrael it's very possible that Smicha actually didn't really end then, and many Rishonim were under the impression, not like the Ramban, but that Smicha continued all the way into the 12th century. In fact, he quotes from many Gaonim who quote halacha lemaisa, that halacha we said before, that they in practice, when they would get civil disputes in front of them that were dinei knasos, so they would put the people into cherim until they would go to Eretz Yisrael to find judgment from smuchim. The fact that geonim, who are certainly after the times of the Gemara, are actually halachically ruling in that fashion, indicates that they believe there to be smuchim in Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam has that approach also, and Rabbeinu Yehud the Barzilloni, quoted frequently by the Rosh, a very big Rishon, he, in one of his Svarim, mentions directly that Smicha is still going on in Eretz Yisrael, and it's not going on elsewhere, and he's right around the time period of the Rambam. So, just a drop earlier, but essentially the same time period. So it is possible that it was going on that late. But it definitely was disbanded during that time, either at the end of time, at the end of the Rambam's life, or just shortly after his death. The Crusades and other matters made things very difficult in the region of Eretz Yisrael. Wars tore it apart. The ability to travel to get Smicha, it seems, was disbanded at that point in time.
How is it you can be posek but not be...
So the smicha we're talking about isn't what we talk about nowadays as rabbanus.
Right.
So that seems to be you were recognized as a Torah authority.
But in the Masechta Shabbos, it talks about how you have to have this title in order to be a posek.
In order to rule on certain things, such as punitive damages. Other things, you don't need that title.
Civil or base things, okay.
You don't need the title. So what it seems is what we call smicha may not be identical, but it's similar to what the people in Bavel had. Now, it was perhaps modeled after the fact that the name and the title is so similar, Rebbe to Rav, is demonstrating that they wanted to know who was qualified and who wasn't qualified. I don't know if there was a formal process or not at those time periods, or just the title was given when somebody was acting as a posek. Posek, keep in mind, it oftentimes meant with civil matters also. But, practically, the title demonstrated you had halachic proficiency to rule in certain areas. Did it have anything to do with communal matters? Not necessarily. We don't find that in the Gemara. Which means it's only to give halachic rulings. Okay? This is definitely going to be a part one, part two series. Next week we're going to get into the women's part. This week we'll just deal with smicha and ordination. But what we see now is that there's the original smicha, and now what we're going to call smicha nowadays, which isn't that, but may have similarities to it, that we try to keep similar procedures, but we're just demonstrating that somebody has proficiency in something. But we do have to differentiate between a communal leader, a position of a rav in a shul, who may actually command some sort of authority, depending on the shul's constitution, bylaws, and how the tzibur in that city sees the position of rav. And historically, sometimes they actually had some official power in terms of in communal needs and even taxation to a degree. Or somebody who has smicha. There are many people in today's day and age who have what we call smicha, but never decide to take a position as rav and never have any aspiration to be a rav. They get the title smicha, showing that they have a proficiency in certain halachic matters to render opinions, and then they have a profession, in whatever it is. It's extremely common in today's day and age. So such a person is a rabbi, but they're not a rabbi of a congregation. And that's something that needs to be addressed when we'll talk about women's ordination and possible issues with that. Are there more issues with taking the position of a shul or pulpit rabbi? And those issues don't exist if it's just to be a posek? We have to address that. What is the problem? We're not going to address it today, but what is the problem with a woman rendering a halachic opinion? We just have to know. What does it mean when anybody gives a halachic opinion? If all we're saying is that this just shows, demonstrates you have a proficiency in halacha, so if you know the halacha, you can render that halacha. If I go up to my friend who's not a rabbi, and he just chazered a certain, masecha, and I say, listen, I'm not holding in this. Am I allowed to do X, Y, Z? And he says, yeah, I just looked it up, it's fine, whatever. And he knows what he's talking about. He doesn't have to be a rabbi to give me advice. It happens in Ma'asim B'Choyom. If my wife is taking care of something, and she's learned Hilchos Shabbos, or Hilchos Kashrus, or Hilchos Nida, or whatever it is, Ma'asim B'Choyom, she doesn't need to ask every little thing to somebody else, or every big thing. If she knows the answer, she's going to do it. We couldn't exist in a world if every time somebody who wasn't, so to speak, qualified as a rav, had a halachic, that means every time you're doing anything in the kitchen, you have to ask them everything? No, if you know it, you know it. So, obviously, there's a certain level of understanding. You call somebody up, you ask somebody, you yourself know it. That's how it goes. Hilchos Nida. If the woman looks at a bedikah that she just did herself, and she knows it's fine, nobody's going to say she has to ask. This color, she's seen it 1,000 times herself, and there's no shiloh on it whatsoever. It's almost completely white, if not completely white. She has to ask every single one? No. The shach says explicitly, she asks her friend, and her friend says, oh, I've seen that exact color. And that color I showed to the rav, it's the exact one, and it's fine. She can rely on the friend. So, where does ordination change things, or does it change things? Maybe it doesn't. We have to address what does it mean to be rough in today's day and age, and what does that mean for women. Lamaisa, just to put things in perspective, back to the original smicha, which is what we were mainly focused on tonight, and now just giving some teasers for next week, I guess. But they did try to reinstate smicha in the times of the Maribe Rav. It seems
what time is that?
the late 15th century, early 16th century also. The Beis Yosef, right, the one who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he actually was a Talmud of the Maribe Rav. It seems that the catalyst was many people who had been anusim in Spain. They felt very guilty about what they had done, and they wanted to get Malkus if they were able to. And they had gone to Eretz Yisrael. And there was a push to reinstate Smicha. There was a lot of people coming to Eretz Yisrael. And the Maribe Rav was part of the committee to reinstate Smicha. The Ralbach in Yerushalayim did not think that they were able to reinstate Smicha. So he objected. And then he said, even if you were able to, based on your premise, you need all the Rabbanim, and I'm not in. So they basically felt that the counter opinion, which were the majority of Rabbanim, the overwhelming majority of Rabbanim of Eretz Yisrael, felt that an overwhelming majority was sufficient. They overruled him, and they went through the procedure, and they did reinstate Smicha at that time, which has subsequently fell apart a couple generations later. As I said, it was questionable in its time. It was debatable, I should say, in its own time. There are notable Torah authorities on both sides of that coin. You know, the Ralbach is the Ralbach, and the Maribe Rav is the Maribe Rav. So that was something to address, and is a historical, very interesting point, historically, and very important point. So we do know that certainly there had not been smicha at that point in time. As I mentioned, the latest possible time that we find evidence of it was 12th century, and it could have stopped as early as the Ramban suggests in the 4th century. But in contemporary times, it has stopped. Now, there have been several other attempts to reinstate smicha, the original smicha. Some have, depending on who you ask, have been more successful than others. There was one, I think, in 2004, 2005, where a bunch of rabbanim felt that they had reinstated smicha. My understanding is that that's fallen apart also. I believe Rabbi Steinsaltz was part of that. And many Chasher Rabbanim were actually part of it. But I do believe that they've discontinued that group. So, as I said, it's not something the older Rishonim agreed could be reinstated. The Rambam himself seems to have been unclear. The most we have written about that is found really in that dispute between the Maribe Rav and the Ralbach, which we still have. It's extant. You know, you can find the writings from that time, and you can see the arguments on both sides, whether or not one can do it. And it has been attempted from time to time. Mir Tashem, we will be Zoche within our lifetime to see Smicha reinstated in a way that all Klal Yisrael will agree, and we'll see the Sanhedrin. There is seemingly a Mesorah that somehow we'll have a Sanhedrin even before Mashiach. The Gemara takes for granted that Eliyahu HaNavi, whoever it is, whether it's Eliyahu himself or a Navi called Eliyahu HaNavi, will actually present his information to the Sanhedrin to proclaim that Mashiach is coming. So it seems that the Gemara takes for granted that there will be a Sanhedrin to which Eliyahu HaNavi is going to be addressing, which means there should be a Sanhedrin first. So, therefore, hopefully that will happen very soon, and Mashiach will happen shortly after, and we'll be zochah to that.